Judith, I want to take you back to your groundbreaking book, Gender Trouble, where you argue that gender is not real. At least it's nothing more than a social construction. And you said gender is performance. Can you explain what you mean?
Well, I'm not sure I said gender is not real exactly. I think I probably tried to say that gender is something that is being made and remade all the time. But when gender's made, it's still real. It's out there. It's part of who we are, and it's part of the world we see. It's part of the media. It's certainly openly debated by athletic organizations and the Catholic Church and the medical profession and psychiatrists. So it's real enough. I just think that there are certain ideas of what gender should be that are not really possible for any living being to attain. So in that sense, gender has an ideal function that has a fictional or phantasmatic dimension, and nobody really attains that, although some people really strive for that. And I suppose the second response I have has to do with whether gender is a performance. The funny word I actually used for that was performative. Gender is performative, which has a dimension of performance to it. But what it really was supposed to underscore is that in doing gender, in acting in certain ways, in speaking in certain ways, we bring about certain ideas of what gender should be. And we even embody them in the way that we act and speak and interact with other people. So to that extent, gender is brought into being through the available modes of discourse that we have.
Is that to say that we're always, to some degree, playing out certain gender roles?
Well, I don't know. You could call them gender roles, but I think it's maybe more profound than that because if you think about it, infants come into the world without obvious gender. They have to be named. They have to be given a sex assignment. I think sex assignment is part of what we might call a gender practice. And a good 10% of those infants present immediate problems. Is this a boy? Is it a girl? What do we call this infant? So the intersex community, for instance, has brought attention to the fact that sex assignment can be pretty tricky and sometimes just wrong, or it has to be understood as something that is revisable over time. An infant might be named a boy or named a girl, but that being, that living human creature, as he, she emerges into the world, may well decide that that's not the right gender, and that assignment doesn't really work.
It's funny how most people tend to either forget about that. I mean, that there aren't always these clear gender markers, or they sort of willfully ignore that. And yet, I guess, you know, people have known about this for years, forever, basically.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to decide what sex a person is on the basis of anatomy or biology, chromosomes or hormones. And it's another thing to have certain ideas about gender immediately come into play when we name an infant as a boy or a girl. And it's all those social expectations and norms that come into the assignment that we call gender. And I suppose provisionally we could say there's some distinction between sex and gender, but I think that sex assignment is part of gendering, bringing about a certain kind of gendered creature. So I do think it's not just that the intersex community has said, look, there are anatomical indeterminacies. There's a continuum. There are hormonal indeterminacies. There are all kinds of chromosomal combinations that don't necessarily fit into male and female. But I think as well in recent years, the transgender and the transsexual community in particular have really called into question whether people have to live with the sex assignment they were given before they had any will and before they had any way to reflect upon themselves or reflect upon what feels right or what kind of categories they need in order to live well in this world.
You know, it strikes me that so much has changed in our culture since you first published your landmark book, Gender Trouble. I mean, that came out in 1990, and there have been huge cultural and social changes, you know, regarding LGBT rights and freedoms, about the acceptance of people who don't fall into sort of clearly defined gender roles. Are we living in a very different culture now than when you first wrote that book?
Well, it depends on who the we might be. And if you're saying, you know, I'm not sure if you're saying educated white people with academic backgrounds of one kind or another. I'm not sure you're saying North American urban culture or, you know, what exactly we mean when we say we. But certainly in certain parts of the world, there have been enormous changes, and you're very right to say that. I think when I was writing Gender Trouble within the context of the feminist and gay lesbian movement in the United States in the late 80s, I had one set of concerns. I thought feminism tended to presume that women were heterosexual or that women were defined in some kind of sexual distinction from men. And I thought that there wasn't sufficient attention being given to other kinds of identities or even ways of living that didn't really conform very well to existing gender categories. And I sought to destabilize those gender categories. But in the years after the publication of Gender Trouble, I think many things did change. Certainly there was a major strengthening of gay, lesbian human rights. But outside of the human rights framework, there was also, I think, a real important social and political focus on bisexuality, on transgender, on butch and femme identities and communities. And these sometimes didn't sit so well with the mainstream human rights agenda. So today, for instance, we see that agenda almost exclusively concerned with marriage rights, which are, of course, very important. It's a very important equality issue. But many other people who are trying to rethink sexuality, intimacy, who you live with, who you die with, who you turn to when you get ill, we're trying to think about kinship outside of marriage as a kind of queer thing to do, though they don't always recognize themselves within the dominant gay and lesbian human rights framework.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we focus for a moment on American culture in particular, and given what you've just said, I mean, sort of this growing awareness of not only gay and lesbian and bisexual people, but also of trans people as well. Do you think definitions of what it means to be a man or a woman are also shifting?
Well, you know, I think when we talk about definitions of what it means to be a man and a woman shifting, we always have to ask where are they shifting? And then we have to ask another question, which is, and what's the reaction to that? And what kind of conflictual scene are we really talking about? Because as much as transgendered people take to the streets and seek to make the street into a safe haven for themselves, they also suffer extraordinary discrimination and sometimes overt brutality. So, you know, this is a struggle. I think it has to be understood not just as a set of categories that are shifting, but those shifts produce a counter response, and then we're in a political dilemma. How to establish transgender rights in a largely transphobic culture? Can transphobic rights be thought about as easily or as clearly as we think about gay marriage rights, for instance? So, you know, those are big, important questions, I think.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, when did this whole subject of gender identity and definition become important to you personally? I mean, was there a particular time in your life when you felt you had to sort out these questions?
Well, I think that's a funny question. I like that question a lot. I think it's fair to say for me, there was never a time that I felt at home in the gender that I was given. But unlike many of my trans friends, I didn't imagine that I could become at home in any gender category. So,
so not even when you were 3 years old, for instance?
No, I don't think so. Not at least as far as my memory goes, you know, we all have slightly distorted ways of thinking about our childhood. So who knows what's true. But I just don't ever remember being at ease with gender. Like, I suppose it had to do with what I was asked to wear or how I was asked to be, and it never really felt right to me. I think my trans friends have felt that they were simply in the wrong gender or someone made the wrong gender assignment. And they believe, and I think they do experience being at home in a chosen gender. But I never made that second choice. So I'm not really at home in any gender.
And you never have been at home in any gender, I mean, for your whole life?
No, I don't think I've ever. Sometimes it doesn't matter to me so much. I'll go with whatever's happening. But no, I don't think I've ever been at home in any gender.
What does that mean for you, never to have been at home in any gender?
It just means that there's a way in which I cannot claim it for myself. I cannot say this is what I am and this is what I'm pleased to be. I can say I'm in an interesting predicament, and luckily I've been able to write about it and even make a living off of it and get some, you know, I got tenure off of it, and apparently there's still some royalties from that book. So, you know, life's not bad. Life's fine out here. But, you know, there's a real difference of opinion here. And it's not really opinion. It's really a difference of experience, I think. Some people really feel like they don't want to have to be one gender or the other. They find their freedom or their desire or their sense of well-being outside of those categories. And yet others want to say, no, let's work with these categories, or I like these categories, or I want to be the other one. I don't want to be the one that I was assigned. I want to be the other one, and that is my place. That's my home, and that's my well-being. So that's really true for a lot of people. And then there are others who say, look, let's struggle with these categories. Let's make woman mean something that I can feel okay about, or let's make man something that I can live with. And they're doing important historical and political work in undergoing that struggle.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, I mean, it's interesting that you wouldn't even take on that identity of woman, however you want to define it, you know, however you might want to remake that definition, but weren't even comfortable with that.
Well, I don't refuse it. I don't refuse it. Like if someone says, excuse me, the woman in the blue shirt, would you please move? I will move. You know, I mean, it's not like I refuse it.
Yeah.
And most of the time I will use a woman's bathroom unless the line is very long. but I really think we should get rid of gender specific bathrooms. And I think that would not be a bad idea. But it's not that I refuse it or I don't check off the box when I have to. It's just that it's not a place where I identify.
Yeah. So why do you think we've had this revolution? I mean, I would describe it as this revolution in the way some people now are much more open about talking about gender roles and more accepting of bisexual people, of the trans community, of all these sort of different definitions. Why now?
Well, I think that there have been feminist, gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, intersex movements that have been working for a long time, and some of the fruits of that labor have become apparent. So that's part of what we're seeing. I think as well that we have to be really careful about this, because there are places in this country, if we're going to talk about American culture as some kind of unity, there are places in this country where it's not okay to be a lesbian mother, where it's not okay to be a trans kid walking down the street, We know this. We know this from the violent crimes that are committed against trans youth and from all kinds of documentation we have about discrimination in child custody law, against gay and lesbian parents, for instance, or even against their capacity to adopt or electively reproduce. So it's not a utopian moment. There are some great strides, and then there are other places where I think we can't see that. If anything, there's a rather intense reaction that we need to be really thoughtful about, and figure out political strategies to counter.
You're really saying that you have to kind of talk about this in very specific places because it plays out differently everywhere.
It does play out differently, and sometimes it plays out differently within a 5-mile radius, right? Like a butch woman is beat up in Penn Station at the same time that there's a fabulous queer party happening, you know, 3 blocks away. right? So do we say things are great in New York? We say that we're in an ongoing struggle. I think that's what we say.
Yeah. Now, the other new thing that's really happened in the last, 10 to 20 years or so is there's new technology out there, social media in particular, which has allowed people to often grow up in a world with fabricated selves. I mean, they can construct their own selves and, you know, their Facebook profiles, their Twitter handles, you know, and that externalized self might be very different from the way people who know them in the physical world would relate to them. Do you think that's had a big impact?
Well, I think I would want to strongly distinguish between making up a personality or making up a gender online, where you have an avatar, for instance, that that substitutes for who you are, and actually something quite different, which is the practice of actually transitioning out of an established or assigned gender into another one. I don't think that's making up a lie or dissimulating in the same way. I think sometimes that's a way of achieving a sense of what it means to live in a truer way with oneself. So I guess I would say that my understanding is that those are two different kinds of things. I mean, there are technologies that have been very important for trans people, especially those who wish to undergo surgery or those who wish to establish through medical or legal means a changed civil status. But I think I don't want to say that those are dissimulated or false or that they're somehow the same as what you're describing as the production of an avatar online.
Mm-hmm. But it does seem that the self has become much more fluid now. I mean, our sense of this of self, and partly because of new technology, not just because of that, though.
Well, you know, I'm not altogether sure about that. I think there are people who are willing to transition who perhaps weren't able to do that previously and who suffered rather badly because they didn't have the resources to do that. But it's not that the resources suddenly made the thought of transitioning possible. Or maybe we could say the resources helped to make that thought possible. But people who've been living to the side of their established gender norm, they've been with us for a really long time. As have obviously trans people. So I'm not sure it's historically right to say that identity has become more fluid. In fact, you know, it's probably might be interesting for you to know that when queer theory was at its heyday about 20 some years ago, it's true that there was an idea circulating that the self was labile, that it could become anything. And, you know, like Madonna, who put on a different face every day, right? There was a kind of hyper flexibility and no identity. And I think that's what allied some of queer theory with what we might call postmodernism. But in fact, you know, I think pretty quickly after that moment of queer theory, a number of people came along, intersex people and trans people in particular, who said, wait a minute, we actually want a fixed identity and we want to be able to fix it. We don't want to be hyper-flexible. We don't want to be changing all the time. We actually want to change our assignment and to do it in order to feel at peace with who we are and to pursue a more livable life. And so queer theory had to kind of stand back for a moment and rethink itself, because here were people who liked the gender binary. They just wanted to be on a different side of it. And here were people who wanted to have an identity, and they wanted to be able to claim their identity, and they wanted it to be fixed, and they wanted it to be fixed in law. And so that was important to hear, and I think it did change things.
Well, then the other thing that's happened more and more recently, again, gaining some more public attention, are people who identify themselves as genderqueer or gender retired. I mean, the whole idea that identity is not about sexuality. Is that changing the dynamic as well?
Well, I think it's true that gender is not about sexuality. You could be any permutation of gender and be straight or gay or bi or none of the above or all of the above, or, you know, there's nothing about gender that implies sexuality. So you can be hyper femme and be a lesbian. You can be hyper masculine, be gay. You can be those things and be bisexual. You can be those things and be heterosexual. I mean, there's a disconnect, I think, between gender and sexuality that's actually important to understand. Gender is really about how you experience a certain way of being socially recognized in the world and how your body enters into public perception and self-perception. I think it's a way of identifying with a set of repeated practices and ways of being recognized, which is very different from sexuality. I think we can't really read somebody's sexuality off their gender in a way that we may have thought once we could.
You've also written about the anxiety that we all, to some degree, feel about gender. I mean, a straight man might wonder, am I man enough? Or a lesbian might ask herself, am I fulfilling my butch lesbian role properly? But I guess I'm wondering where that anxiety comes from. Is that just socially constructed? I mean, these are the messages that we get? Or is there anything innate about that?
Well, I do think when certain gender norms become too rigid or too exacting, that no one can really live up to them, and they can produce a sense of anxiety or failure. But on the other hand, when gender norms become more relaxed or people don't necessarily have a fixed idea of what a gender should be, it seems to me that there's a chance that people could live a little bit more freely. Of course, some people think without fixed gender norms, they're going to have a lot of anxiety because they're not going to know how to act at all. And they want their gender norms in order to actually live more freely. So, you know, you have to realize that there's no one way of looking at it.
This whole business of what it means to be free is kind of fascinating, actually. I mean, too much freedom can probably drive some people a little crazy.
Too much freedom could drive some people a little crazy. That's true. But then, you know, knowing what your own internal limits are, that's very different from feeling frightened that the police are going to impose some terrible set of limits on you, or that the psychiatric profession is going to put you away for whatever gender identity you happen to choose. And I think we have to distinguish between those, how to think about, you know, what makes a particular life livable. That's something that each of us has to figure out, and we tend to figure it out with other people who are also trying to figure it out.
Yeah, we've been talking about the impact of the trans movement, of questions about intersexuality, and I mean, it's led a lot of people to wonder that, or to consider that maybe there are not just two ways to do gender, but it seems that most people, the vast majority of people, generally agree there still is some absolute truth about biological sex. I mean, with the exception of that roughly 10% of people you say are sort of indeterminate whether they're boy or girl when they're born, but for the most part, people assume that there is a distinct sexual identity at the biological level. Does that need to be called into question as well?
Well, I think we probably have to distinguish between sex assignment and sexual identity. So it's true that most people believe that sex assignment works. In other words, when a doctor or a health professional says, yes, this is a boy or this is a girl, that that name fits and it fits because of certain identifiable physical features or biological or chromosomal features of this infant. I think that's right. Most people do believe in that. But sexual identity is a different thing. Sexual identity is how you actually define your sexuality. So you could be indisputably, as it were, female, but your sexual identity could be any number of things. It could be bisexual, it could be lesbian, it could turn out to be very heterosexual. It could be that you live a long life and you've got 10 years with some guy and another 10 with some woman, and and then you spend some indeterminate years going between or whatever. And people have, you know, they live lives that have stories in them that they don't always fit into single categories.
And you're saying sexual identity is different than gender identity.
Well, sexual identity is different from gender identity, and both of them are different from sex assignment. I think we have to make that distinction. You can have a sex assignment. You can understand yourself as female, and you could have a gender identity as butch or even as trans, and you could have a sexual identity as anything, as heterosexual, as bi, as metro, as gay, lesbian. Whatever. So we have to think carefully about how these categories are separate from each other.
It seems to me that we, at least in some parts of Western culture, are kind of at an unusual and even a historic point where it's really possible to question the gender binary, that they're sort of, you know, they're just two genders and you have to kind of choose between them. And I guess I wonder what it would mean to move into a world without gender norms. What would that look like?
Well, it doesn't mean there are no gender norms if there are more than two genders. Anne Fausto Sterling, the historian of science, feminist historian of science, proposed five different ways of thinking about gender. And I remember some years ago, the Pope at the time was very furious about that. he wanted it to go back to two, and he wanted them to be mandated by nature and by religious authority. But it doesn't mean that there are no norms if there are more than two genders. It may be that norms function differently.
Let me rephrase it a different way then. Could we talk about a post-gender world? I mean, is that even conceivable?
Well, I think that there are people who would talk about a post-gender world. I don't think that I'm one of them. But people who talk about a listen to what we're saying here. Are we saying if there are more than two genders, or if there are more ways of understanding gender than as simply men and women, are we then post-gender? No, we're not post-gender. If we decided we were post-gender on that basis, we would be saying that the only genders that exist are men and women. And that if we go beyond them, we're post-gender. So no. it's got to be the case that there can be other ways of living and doing gender that aren't quite adequately handled by those two categories. It doesn't mean we're beyond gender itself. It means gender itself has changed. It means that gender itself has to be conceptualized differently. But it doesn't mean we abandon gender or that we've suddenly leapt into a universe without gender.
Well, it sounds like you wouldn't want to live in a post-gender world. You yourself, I mean, what you want is to live in a world that recognizes many different genders.
That's true. And also the complexity of gender and why it is that sometimes it doesn't really conform to any category. I think there are liminal figures who really press against gender norms as we know them, and we don't really have good vocabulary for them sometimes, and we have to let our unknowingness come to the fore. Like, yeah, don't know how to proceed here. And, you know, I mean, I was in a hotel room in London just last month where the guy who came to check my minibar, he opened the door and he said, good afternoon, sir, madam, sir, madam, sir, madam, sir, madam. And it went on. I must tell you, it went on for, I mean, I felt bad for him. He was obviously suffering, and I should have just relieved his anxiety and given him one of those names.
Or he knew who you were academically, and you know.
No, he had no idea. He had no idea. He had no idea at all. But it went on, sir, madam, and it was a terrible tick, and it was infinite. It was never ever going to stop. And I did something that I felt a little bad about later. Interestingly enough, I tried to say it kindly, do you think it's necessary to determine my gender in order to check the minibar? And he was like, no, of course not, sir, madam, sir, madam. And then, of course, he was trying to be polite, and he went back to the sir, madam, and he couldn't stop, and I felt terrible about it. And oddly enough, I don't know what was happening that week, but the next morning, I was in the hotel pool. I was in the women's locker room changing, and I had just put my clothes back on, and a young woman came in, and she said, oh, I'm confused. I think we're in the wrong place here. I said, no, I'm sure you're in the right place. She said, you know, did the blokes get dressed with the girls? I don't really know. And I said, no, and then I saw she had great anxiety. And so this time, feeling guilty about the other time, I said, no, I'm not a bloke, I said. But, you know, was I expressing something true about myself? Not really. I was just taking her out of her misery. And then, of course, she wanted to apologize to me, which is much worse, right? Because I don't need anybody's apology. It's not an insult to call me a bloke, right? It's like, no, that's not an insult. It's like, don't apologize. And I just realized there was no getting out of these conversations. They were terrible in a way, but also kind of hilarious.
Well, it sounds like you kind of like having those conversations. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a, you know, you make people think, you know, an extra second or an extra minute, you know, about some of their assumptions.
Well, but it's so often taken as rude, you know, like if you stop someone from making an assumption and you say, no, I'm not a lady, like, ladies, what shall we eat tonight? It's like, well, I'm not a lady, but I would like to eat something, or I've never been a lady. I hope, you know, and some people enjoy it and they go with it and they say, okay, so what do I call you? Or, you know, what would you prefer? Or something like that. They take it up and they're fine. But other people are deeply offended because for them, ladies and gentlemen or men and women, that's protocol, right? That's how we know it's a norm.
Right,
it's protocol.
Right.
It's what polite people do. And they were trying to address me by my gender as a way of being polite. But unfortunately, that very address was an act of misrecognition.
I mean, it's actually fascinating to think about this. I mean, just sort of at this, what would seem to be this very superficial level of gentility and, you know, having this kind of polite social conversation, if you get rid of those usual gender assumptions, you know, I'm not sure how you address people.
Well, I mean, it is odd that the person who feels misaddressed is understood to be rude if they say something to that effect, like, no, don't call me that. Actually, I am this, or you can call me this. I'm not a lady, but I'm glad to order dinner here. You know, they experience it as very aggressive sometimes. It's like, okay, so it's aggressive. And I think, why is that aggressive? Why wouldn't you want to know how somebody wanted to be addressed? And I think it happens most for trans people who sometimes do get called by the wrong pronoun, or people treat them with certain kind of circumspection because they don't know how to address them. And actually, the thing to do is just to come forward. How do you like to be addressed?
Yeah.
What do you call yourself? What's your preferred pronoun? How do you like to be addressed? That would be a polite thing to do. That seems perfectly polite, and it's not that very hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Is this an exciting time for you right now, as someone who has watched these questions for so long and seen so much change really in the last couple of decades?
Well, in certain ways. I mean, I look at younger generations and I see that some people are living more easily than I was able to live, or many people I knew were able to live. So I'm very pleased about that. At the same time, I'm concerned about the rise of certain forms of gay conservatism. Yet people want, you know, marriage and they want property and they want to join the army and they want to kill people and, you know, they can engage in some pretty seriously reactionary discourse and that's alarming to me. So I think as we've become a much more diverse population, we also now spread across the political spectrum and there's not the same level of political consensus as there used to be.
This has been fascinating. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.